Good morning, I'm Bob Darrell and I am alcoholic. After a moment of silence, would you join me in a prayer? Lord, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery. All for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much needed new experience in my own recovery. Amen. Good morning. We're gonna finish up and make the transition from step two into step three this morning. We had been going through some parts of the book that We Agnostics. And I want to touch on two little parts out of We Agnostics. One is really the essence of what I have to do in step two. And it's a lot simpler than I imagined. And Bill refers to that in the 12 by 12 when he talks about the hoops we have to jump through in step two are a lot easier than we ever thought. And in the middle of page 46, there's a paragraph, and it talks about two things. It doesn't even really say I have to believe. If I can just do two things, I'll be on my way. And it says, the second line down in the middle paragraph in the page, it says, let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to, first, lay aside prejudice, and second, express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. I think sometimes one of the most misunderstood things in Alcoholics Anonymous is the last couple words in the third step where it says, God as we understood him. And it's easy, and I to imply from that, as a lot of new people do, as I did, that I must first understand God. And it's not a closed in expression. It's a broad, open ended expression, meaning that you don't have to understand anything, or anything you understand is approachable. It's of your understanding, whatever, from 0 to 100 on any scale, whatever that is. And I misinterpreted that as I had to understand God. And the book really comes out and tells me very point blank that you don't even try. And the only reason I would try anyway is because the stuff I try to understand I can control. I mean, that's the only reason I try to understand God. So I shoot a couple angles here to get a little bigger piece of the pie. I want a little more grace of this grace thing that you guys talk about than everybody else has, because I definitely need it more. I can tell. I can feel it. And so I don't have to understand God. If I can do these two things, lay aside prejudice. I didn't know what prejudice was. It comes from a Latin word, to prejudge. It is all my opinions, my judgments, my preconceived notions about God, about spiritual terms. If I can get to a point where, if I can move towards a point of being childlike and know nothing, and that's a hard thing to do for opinionated guys like me who think they know all kinds of things. I know stuff I don't even know. I mean, you can ask me a question about something I don't even know anything about, and I'll tell you the answer. I'll make one up on the spot because I want to be the I know guy, right? That's the kind of ego I came in here with. So to get childlike enough to know that I don't know. And then the second thing it says is to express even a willingness. And the wisdom of the old timers when I was new, they had me taking actions that seemed to me, in my judgment, inappropriate. They had me getting down on my knees and physically getting on my knees and praying every morning when I didn't even really believe in God as of yet. You know, I remember arguing with this guy. I said, you know, well, I'll feel like a hypocrite doing that. He says, you've been a hypocrite all your life. What's the difference? Well, it's true. I mean, I never did what I said I was going to do. I was the guy who owned. I was owned by my feelings. I'd tell you, oh yeah, I'll come over and help you. When it came time to come over and help you, if I didn't feel like it, I'd do something different. I was owned by my emotions, childish emotions. So I was a hypocrite. So I started, I was living in a halfway house. And I would go in the bathroom and I'd feel stupid. I'd lock the door, make sure the curtains are pulled over the window tight, push the rug underneath the crack in the door to pray, to get down on my knees, as if I think somebody's going to look under the crack and see me praying or something. I don't know. I'm crazy. And I'd get down on my knees and I'd say that simple little prayers like, whatever's there, I need help today. Please help me to stay sober. And I'd get down on my knees at night and I'd thank whatever that was. And some funny things started happening to me. It was a while before I could connect the dots and realize that they were initiated by those actions. And one of the things that started happening to me was I started having a lot of eerie good luck. Like eerie good luck. I mean like, and I'm not a good luck kind of guy. I'm a bad luck magnet. You know what I mean? I'm a bad luck man. And funny things would start happening to me. Like most new people, my first couple years of sobriety, I would go on these emotional roller coasters for no reason. I could be just sitting in a meeting, feeling good, and all of a sudden it'd be like some key would turn in my head and I'd just get depressed all of a sudden and feel like awful. And sometimes I'd be like that and I wouldn't know what to do and I'd say, well, they'd say prayer. So I'd say, God, please help me. I'd go to a meeting or I'd be at a meeting and somebody would start sharing, some guy I don't even know, and he would be talking exactly about what's going on in my life. I mean exactly. And I don't know how he got that. And he's got an answer for me. And that didn't happen to me once or twice. That happened to me over and over and over again. I was in early sobriety. I couldn't get a job. And the perfect job just came to me. I mean, it wasn't the job I really wanted. God had that. But it was the perfect job for a guy like me. It got me out of the halfway house. It got me, gave me room and board. It was a job as a live-in house manager for a treatment center for teenagers. It put me in a safe, sober recovery environment, gave me room and board, and it got me out of the halfway house. And my one roommate in the halfway house was selling heroin, and the other one was dealing marijuana. I mean, I don't know how much longer I could have stayed there, you know, without going over off the deep end. And I started to see that there was something's going on here. Something. And I'm a skeptic, and I've always been a skeptic, and I'm a cynic. You know, and I don't believe easily, and I'm the guy that, because I want your approval, I would come to AA meetings and talk like I believe in God way before I really did. I mean, because it was the thing to, it was the proper thing to say in AA, and I, God forbid you'd reject me here because I had nowhere else to go, so I wanted to be liked here. But I started to really come to believe the only way that a guy like me, I think, that's wired the way I'm wired, could ever come to believe, God had to come to me. And I just made a tiny little actions, just tiny little actions, and God came the rest of the way. He was so, so gracious in my life for a guy like me, who really was a skeptic and a cynic and a judgmental kind of guy. And what my experience was like as it evolved was very similar to, I heard a story years ago about this over in London, and I just came from there, and they still do this in some parts of London. The streets have gas street lights. And there was a guy years ago who would go around the streets of London with a long pole with a flame on the end, and he would light the street lights. And he was called a lamplighter. And if you climbed up to the top of one of those towers in London or one of those high buildings and looked out over the city at twilight, you couldn't see where the lamplighter was, but you could always see where he'd been by the lights in the city. And I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at 2 years sober, or 2.5 years sober, and I couldn't see where God was at that moment. But I'll tell you, I could see where he'd been. In my life, so clearly, and even more distinctly, I could see where he'd been in the guys that I watched get sober after me. You know, I started doing H&I work when I was brand new, and I would go back into the detoxes in the prison, and some of these guys I'd watch, I would see them in detox, and I would talk to them, and they were more dead than alive. These were hopeless, hopeless, homeless, used up human beings that don't have a chance, that alcohol has just demoralized them and screwed them up mentally and emotionally, that they'll never save their own life. They don't even like themselves enough to do that. And then they start taking simple actions that open this door. And then 6 or 8 months later, I see them get their kids back. I see them in meetings with guys that they're trying to sponsor, and the lights are on, and I watch them turn the corner. And man, that has to be some kind of power that is beyond anything I could imagine, that is changing them. And it's easier, I think, for us to see God's hand in others than it is in ourselves, because God's hand works so slow. I mean, well, he's old. I mean, and it's hard to see him work in my life because it's such a slow evolution sometimes, and I live the change. It's like trying to stand in front of a mirror and watch your hair grow. It doesn't mean that it doesn't grow. It's just a slow thing. But I could see it in you much clearer and easier. It took a longer time to see it in me. On page 55, this is an amazing page. And the two paragraphs in the middle of this page, it says exactly when, exactly where, and exactly how I will connect with this juice, this grace, this power in the universe that I will die without. The book had said, lack of power is my dilemma. Alcoholics Anonymous is really a quest for power by people who are dying and desperate for power, by people who have exhausted every source of power they could find. And alcohol... And combinations of alcohol and drugs was a tremendous source of power for a while. I mean, it was. I mean, think about it. What you have something that at one time, no matter how bleak and lonely and desolate this world seemed, no matter how depressing it was, 5 shots of Jack Daniels and the world would shape up. It would just get better. That's power. That's true. It's power to come out and play. It's power to talk to people. Power to integrate myself when I felt like I was dying of loneliness. Power to be a part of. Power to have some control over my emotional nature. Power to just rise above my depressive tendencies. Power to shake off the anxieties that just seem to eat my lunch and the worries. That's power. And I must find this power somehow, or I will perish. And on page 55, it starts, says in the middle of the page, is this first, second full paragraph. It says, actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child, deep down within me, is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured, which it may be blocked. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. But in some form or other, it is there for faith in a power greater than ourselves, and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we had for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, fearless and searching. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality in capital letters, the great reality deep down within us. And when? In the last analysis. After I've looked everywhere else on the planet for power in this cosmic Easter egg to to claim my Easter egg hunt to claim my inheritance is I look everywhere else and find nothing. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. And that's really my story of this last analysis stuff. You know, I spent 7.5 years fighting alcoholism, and I sought help and power to do that in a lot of places. I went to some of the greatest psychiatrists in the world. My dad was politically connected. He got me in to see people that you couldn't get in to see unless you were like a movie star or something. These amazing psychiatrists that had founded whole movements of psychotherapy, and I went to therapy for them, and nothing changed. I tried the medications of the era that were popular at the time by psychiatrists for guys like me, and nothing changed. I did religions. I did meditations. I did chanting. I did everything that was available, and nothing seemed to change. And through all of that, on a regular basis, I keep ending up in rooms full of alcoholics. Now, it's not that I have alcoholism, but every time I drink, I end up where all the alcoholics are at. You know, I haven't connected the dots with that one yet. And I'm looking everywhere else, and I keep ending up with you. And I come in here, and I look for power for my first couple years of sobriety everywhere else. Jobs and relationships, money, activities, committee positions, general service. I'm looking for juice. I'm looking for validation. I'm looking for security. I'm looking for the power to shore up my life and fill my vacancies everywhere else. And then after several years of sobriety, I started to be, as Scott talked about on page 53 last night, started to become crushed by these self-imposed crises I could not postpone or evade. And I had to fearlessly face this proposition and start to go back through the work again, because I had missed a lot of stuff. And much to my surprise is that I started, as I did the work to clear away this channel, to clear away the pomp, the calamity, the worship of other things, which really is completely touched on and cleared away in steps 4 through 7. As I cleared away that stuff, a presence started to come into my life. Not a constant presence, but a presence that is often overshadowed by, as Bill uses a term I love, the worldly clamors. You know, when I get in my head, no, I can't, when I'm in my head, I don't feel God's presence in my head. You know why? Because when I'm in my head, I'm not in the place where God is. It tells you in chapter 5 exactly where you're going to find God. It says, there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him in a place it refers to that most of us seldom visit. And you find him now. Right? I mean, now. Even as I'm saying that, some of you aren't even here. You're in your head thinking, oh, I can't wait to tell Joe that. And oh, boy. You're not even here as I'm saying that. You're somewhere else, right? So that I would start to connect, if I could clear away those three things. And I heard a story by a guy who wasn't an AA, a guy named Earl Nightingale, who was he told this story, and he said this is a true story, and it was an account of a thing that happened in South Africa. And when I heard this story, it blew my mind, because it was exactly what had happened to me. And he told this story about this guy who grew up in South Africa, and he had inherited a ranch from his dad. And it wasn't like a spectacular ranch, but it was a nice ranch. A ranch that would have secured him and his family a nice living for generations to come, a nice, comfortable existence. But he inherited the ranch at a time when the diamond boom was on in South Africa, and there were people that were becoming overnight Rockefeller, Bill Gates, mega rich. And the more he heard the stories of their wealth and their abundance, the more dissatisfied he became with what he had. Sound familiar? And he finally, after a while, he couldn't take it anymore. He sold his ranch, took the money, invested it in equipment to go prospecting and searching for diamonds, and went out to the bush, obsessed with striking it rich. And he never did find diamonds out there. And he died out there bitter and alone, and had a miserable existence. And it came to pass that this ranch he sold it to two developers, and they were going to develop some of the property, and they were moving these stones out of the way one day, and they found these unusual-looking rocks, and they'd never seen anything quite like them before, and they took them to a guy, and the guy said, well, they're diamonds, and they're rough, and they cut them and clean them up, and they found that this ranch was the largest diamond deposit ever found on the planet, and... These brothers one day, they all of a sudden they have to form this huge corporation to mine and market these diamonds. And the one guy says to the other, well, what do we call this corporation? And the guy says, I don't know. He says, well, why don't we name it after that poor SOB that died out in the bush that we bought this ranch from? And the guy said, that's a good idea. What was his name again? Oh, it was De Beers. That's right. And they named this company after De Beers. And I'm reading that and I'm thinking to myself, I'm that idiot. I'm that guy. I'm looking everywhere else, and God keeps throwing this stuff at me. You know, I go, I'm sitting in meetings thinking how I'm going to connect with God, and what should I do to make my recovery better? And in the background, somebody's reading this thing, goes, and these are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. And I'm, God, I wish he'd stop, get that over. I'm interfering with my thinking here. I'm that nut. And this thing that I will find the great reality, the presence of God, presence like as opposed to past and future, the presence of God in my life, if I can clear away the things that keep me from showing up in my life right now, the things that keep me up in here, that keep me in the bondage of self, this pomp. And if you don't know what pomp is, it's ego. I am capable of being so full of myself and my judgments and my opinions, there's no room for God's grace. I could be that self-consumed. And calamity, oh, we all know what calamity is. The book says we're producers of confusion rather than harmony. You know, I'm a producer of calamity. Father Martin had a great saying once. I heard him say this one of his talks, and it was so... right on. He said, you can go to any workplace in the country and pick out the alcoholics not by the alcohol in their breath. He says, look for the people that everybody walks on eggshells around. You know, we produce calamity. We produce confusion. There's no alcoholic with untreated alcoholism is ever accused of being a source of harmony. I mean, it never happens. We're the opposite, you know? And this worship of other things, I didn't get that for a long time. And I was sober about a year and a half, and I was coming out of my first sober relationship. And I'll tell you, there's not a person on the planet more self-obsessed than a guy ending his first sober relationship. I mean, you can go up to a guy like that and say, I just came from the doctor, I have terminal cancer and 2 weeks to live. And he'll go, and you know what else she said, man? It's just on you, right here, like that creature, an alien that attaches itself to you. You're just on, it's on you. And so I'm like that, and I go to this meeting, and I can't hear anything in the meeting because she's a member of AA and she's not in that meeting, and because she's not in that meeting, some hideous force has implanted a spring in the back of my neck, and every time the door to the meeting opens, I just go like that. You know, I can't help it. And then when the door is not opening, I'm not listening to anything because I'm in my head thinking about driving by her house and thinking about, you know, I'll say this to her and then she'll say that and then I'll say this and then she'll say that. And then I'll hit her with this. Oh, and it'll humble her. She'll realize how wrong she was, beg my forgiveness, be properly ashamed of herself, and it'll be wonderful. And when you're like, God can be trying to talk to me through the people in the meeting, and I'm not hearing anything. I'm locked up in here. And the meeting's over. I've heard nothing. I end up going out to coffee with some people, and I end up in this coffee shop, me and a guy from California who was a visitor, a guy from Glendale, and who I've never seen since. I've even actually looked for him. I don't know. I've never found him since. And this guy's sitting there, and he's patiently listening to me talk about this relationship for 20 or 30 minutes. I think his eyes glazed over about 10, you know. But he's a very patient guy. He's listening to me go on and on about her and her. And when I'm done and I run out of gas, he says to me, you ever thought about the first commandment? And I'm kind of new. I'm a year and a half sober. I'm still have a little bit of prejudices from my childhood. And I said to him, something like, oh, I'm not really into that. I'm just into AA. And he smiles and he goes, yeah, he says, I know. He says, guys like me and you, we never get past the thou shalt not. He said, I think the Ten Commandments lost something in the translation out of the Aramaic and through the Latin into the English. He says, I think they were originally written as statements of spiritual cause and effect. He said that in the first commandment, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have false gods before me. He says, I think you could throw out the thou shalt not. He said, I think with God, he loves you no matter what. You can put anything you want between you and God. It's perfectly all right with God. The problem is, you've just put something between you and God. You've just blocked the light. You now are in the shadow. You live in the shadow of what you put there. And he said, what you worship or put between you and God is worship, he says, doesn't mean to bow down to something. It means to just obsessively turn your consciousness towards. He said, you want to know what you worship? He says, at the end of the day, make a pie graph of everything you've been thinking about, and the thing that owns the pie graph is what you have been obsessively turning your consciousness towards. And when he said that, I pictured a pie with a tiny little sliver for work and a little sliver for A, and the rest of the pie was her. And no wonder I felt lost and desolate and in the dark of my soul was in the dark because I put myself there. And I did that. I did that in a false quest for power because I was functioning under an illusion. The illusion is if I had her in my life, that then it would complete me. I will have wrested happiness and satisfaction out of this world by managing well. And I wish I could tell you, from that moment on, I've never done that again, but I've done that a lot. I've done that with relationships. I've done it with work. I've done it with things I want to be right about, and I got to make you see. I've done it about resentments. I've done it about fears that I've obsessed on, and we'll talk about this in the inventory, obsessed on to the point where I've made them come true. I've done it about a lot of stuff. And every time I do that, I live in its shadow and I'm cut off from the light. And it's not a moral judgment. God doesn't stop loving me. I sort of sometimes imagine that he weeps for the loss of me, that he loves me that much. There's a line in our book that says that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. And that has really, really been my case. I'll tell you, if God was somebody like me, Bob wouldn't have got helped. George Bernard Shaw said something that was remarkable. He said that God created us in his own image, and then unfortunately we turned around and returned the favor. And start to imagine that God has all the little judgments and the pettiness that I have. And, you know, because if I was God, first of all, half of you'd be dead right before the end of the day. Just. That's part of my prejudices. And I heard a guy a few years ago, a friend of mine from California named Jim, tell a story about going to Florence, Italy. And I'm going there. Ever since I heard this story, I'm going there for about 10 days with before the international with a couple of the guys I sponsored, because I've always wanted to go there. And he said he was in Florence, and it's the center of the Renaissance art. And he told this story about walking around, looking at all these sculptures, and he was looking at it. He said it was a Donatelli exhibit. And he walked into this one room, and he said there was a life-size statue of the Mary Magdalene that stopped his heart. And he said it was unlike any statue of Mary Magdalene he'd ever seen. Most of the depictions he'd seen of Mary Magdalene showed her with long flowing hair and robes, and she was very beautiful. He said this was not like that. This was a depiction of Mary Magdalene where her face was etched with pain and emotion. And he said that she looked like she had been turning tricks on the back alleys of Jerusalem for years. And she stood there, and he said as he looked at her, he started to weep because she had her hand out like this and an expression on her face as if it said, "This could be for me? For me?" And when Jim's told that story, I started crying because it touched something within me, a deep-seated feeling of unworthiness. And this a friend of mine says something that he says, maybe your feeling of unworthiness is just good judgment. Because the truth is, I probably don't deserve the help I've gotten, you know, which really gives me a different view of the universe than I've always had. It is the treatment I've gotten from this gracious creator of the universe that lets me know how wrong all my old ideas have been, that this could be for me and is and always will be. And if I ever lose this, it will not be from God's end. It will be from mine. Because I will be the guy that will put something obsessively between me and God. He will never turn his back on me. He will wait patiently, as we would wait for our children if they get lost. He would wait. And that, to know that, doesn't make me any less alcoholic. But it sure gives me hope that no matter how far out I may ever get, if I can just turn my consciousness back towards him and back towards my primary purpose of helping his kids, that I will be reunited with that power source. And if I'm the guy who gets to choose every day, God is either everything or he's nothing. He either is or he isn't. Bob, 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 what's your choice going to be? Every day I get that choice. I've had days where I've chosen poorly. I've had days where spiritually bad hair days where I just can't imagine life without something, some kind of thing. And it can be different. It can be different, and I just grab onto that. And yeah, you know what I think hell is? It's holding on to something that you intellectually know you should be letting go of. You know what I mean? Right? If there's a hell on earth, it's in the abyss that opens up between what I'm really doing and what I know I should be doing. That brings us to one of my favorite parts of the book, a part of the book that turned my life around and was really the beginning for me. And it starts on page 60, and it's the section that leads up to the third step prayer. And it's really the best description of why my life is unmanageable sober. And I'll tell you, I don't think that what they're talking about is drunken behavior. I think they're talking about me when I quit drinking. This is me when I quit drinking. And it starts on page 60, and it talks about the three pertinent ideas that everything we've done in Alcoholics Anonymous up to this point, the chapter of the agnostics, the description of the alcoholic, and there's several, the personal adventures, our stories, our experience, strength, and hope, everything we do to this point brings me to three pertinent ideas. A, pertinent idea A, that I am alcoholic and could not manage, could not manage my own life. I have the guys I sponsor go through this and take a pencil and cross out the plural pronouns and change them to the singular and read it like that. It reads different when you read it like that. It's easy to read this in the plural pronouns, and you know, as I did in early sobriety, my sponsor had me read this, and I'd read this, and it wasn't me, but I could sure see how this was a lot of those people in AA, this self-centeredness and this wanting to run the whole show thing they're talking about in there. It became very clear to me. And I thought, well, you know, he wanted me to read this so I could straighten him out, because they need straightening out. But I couldn't see it was me. And Bill in the ABCs, when he says, and could not manage your own life, that's really very clear for me. See, I can take step one, as it is in the beginning of this chapter. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. Had, to me, I can interpret that as past tense. I can interpret that as, you know, when I was drinking. But now I'm not drinking and I'm starting to think clearly. Let me at my life. There used to be talk in AA years ago, and I haven't heard it. I'm the only one who ever talks about it anymore, about the second surrender. How we come here broken by the bag and the bottle, and in sobriety, in this delusion of resting happiness and satisfaction out of this world by managing well, that I will crash and burn and fail and be demoralized and crushed by self-imposed crises in sobriety, that eventually I will try to keep from hitting that bottom sober by juggling this juggling act of my life. And I will do everything to keep from hitting that bottom. But it is the brokenness of my sobriety and my absolute failure to rest happiness and satisfaction in this world by my own management, to my failure at fixing me, that is the greatest blessing I will ever have, because that and that only will bring a guy like me to the table when it comes to God in sobriety. Why would I do it? If I can manage my own life sober, why would I have to desperately seek new management? I will just manage it. And as long as I have the delusion that I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world, I am not really brought to the table. I'll circle the table, but I ain't sitting down at it because I don't have to. And I'm one of those have-to guys. I wish for years that I was one of those kind of guys that could kind of just sort of see how I should be doing something. And, oh, yeah, and I'll just go be that way. And I ain't that way. I am brought to the table either through pain and occasionally by inspiration, but never by cognizant decision. So I could not manage my own life sober. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And the only way that we know that is by trying. We try everything we can. Earlier in the book, and there is a solution, it says we get to a place where there was nothing left but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We get to that point because we've tried everything that there was, and there's nothing left. I don't know what would have become of me if the day I was checking in to detox, if I'd have seen an ad for a new treatment for alcoholism or a new medication or something, I don't know. I don't know if I'd probably have a different sobriety date if somebody would have given me $100 the day I was checking into detox. You know, I wish I had more moral fiber than that, but I don't. I've been a different sobriety date, if I had one at all. So no human power could have relieved my alcoholism that God could and would if he were sought. So my job is to become a seeker. And I don't think that we know that this is true. I don't think C is really real. We own C for a while here. Maybe you take it on faith and then eventually the faith becomes trust because it becomes real. But I did a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous in my early sobriety. Not because I would believe they would work. I just was so demoralized. I just would do whatever you said to do. And often doing it thinking that this is a waste of time. And then you do that a couple times and it works, and then you start to think a little different. You start thinking maybe it's not a waste of time. Maybe there really is something. And I'll tell you something, your track record and God's track record with me has been 100%. There's nothing in this book or that my sponsor has told me to do to date that hasn't been for my ultimate fulfillment, my ultimate happiness and satisfaction, my ultimate improvement of my ability to love, to be a part of, to enhance my spirit. There's nothing you've told me to do that hasn't. And I'm waiting because I'll dime you all out. The minute you give me one bad thing, I'll dime you all out. I'll be around telling everybody. You know what they told me to do? Not yet. Not once. But I've been very, very blessed with sponsorship. And I think sponsorship is a blessing. I think God's hands. Not my sponsor's not infallible. But you know what's infallible? The power that shows up between us when he's trying to help me. That is what I bet my life on. I'm not infallible with my own guys. But if you're sitting here and you sponsor a lot of people, you will notice a dynamic that happens. A guy will come to me with a problem, and I will sit there in amazement as I listen to my mouth say things I don't even know. That are true. That are right, not only true, right on the money. And then he'll go, a month later, be telling everybody how I really helped him. And then I'll kind of take credit for it. Yeah, yeah. Aren't I wonderful? That ain't me. There's something happens to me. Something happens to me when I'm thinking about you and I've put me aside. Some presence moves into my life. That's the juice in Alcoholics Anonymous. A couple things I want to talk about. Page 62, it talks about the root of our problem, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. The root. Without the root, nothing that grows can exist. It's what feeds the bush, the tree, the plant. It's what it all comes from. And if that's true, then what they're saying is that underneath every trouble that I will ever have in my life, underneath my obsession with alcohol, underneath sex and romance problems, underneath work problems, underneath people problems, underneath emotional problems, underneath mental problems, underneath finance problems, underneath every trouble or problem I would ever have, the root is selfishness, self-centeredness, the root. It's where it all comes from. And I couldn't see that. I tell you, I didn't even think I was self-centered when I first got sober. I didn't know what self-centered meant. I thought self-centered people were overconfident and composed and put together and kind of self-assured people. And I was none of that. I just felt like I was a squirrel cage. I felt I had no self-esteem. I think and feel very poorly about myself continually. And I'm in a meeting one day, and a woman is sharing her experience with selfishness, self-centeredness. It's a topic, and I'm sitting in the meeting, and I'm not really even paying attention. My mind is wandering, and I hear her use a term that blew my mind. She used the term self-absorbed. And it hit me like a 2x4, because I'm sitting in the meeting thinking about myself, thinking about what I'll say if I'm called on, what it'll sound like, what you'll think of what I'll say, how I should sit while I'm saying it to look like I know what I'm talking about. I'm thinking about my relationships. I'm thinking about my job. I'm thinking about my finances. I'm examining my emotions to the point of excruciating pain. I'm sitting there totally absorbed in myself, and she uses the term self-absorbed. And it was like a light went on. It was like, oh my God, I'm sitting here totally consumed in myself. That's what self-centered means. Means my consciousness is centered on myself. And I didn't get that up until that time. And it was an amazing revelation, realization for me. And from that, all of a sudden I could, it was like a curtain had lifted. And I could start to see it in all these aspects of my life. I started realizing the reason I have never sober felt like I fit out here in the world is that the reality is I don't even live out here. I live up here. And self-obsessed, self-centered people are not of this world. We're of this one. Right? And I live up here most of the time. When it talks earlier in the book about being rocketed into the fourth dimension, and that fourth, Scott talked about it, about the physicist talking about the fourth dimension being time. I remember asking a guy that was in our group, a scientist, well, what does that mean, this fourth dimension? He told me about time. I says, but what's that mean? What's that have to do with me? And he said, well, maybe if you were rocketed into the fourth dimension, you'd hear this loud pop as your head came out of your butt and you'd actually show up in your life. Like, right? but isn't that what alcohol... Remember walking into a bar and you got your life and your emotions and your future and your past kind of on you, like that creature, an alien that attaches itself to your face, and you're just locked up in here, and everything out here is so disconnected, and so you're so dissociated from life and people, and after about 5 shots of Jack Daniels, pop, I could be right here. I could, after 7 shots, I loved everybody. I love you, man. Hugging people and, listening to their problems. And, oh, she did that to you. Oh, just really being present. I was present in my life. Not at the end of my drinking. The end of my drinking, I was just as disconnected drunk as I was sober. But in the early days, tremendous stuff. Tremendous. So that maybe alcohol relieved me of the bondage of self. It brought me into this world at one time, and then when it turned on me, and it would no longer do that, the desolation and loneliness of alcoholism is overwhelming. That we are the people who have tasted the glory, tasted a type of integration and intimacy and a feeling of belonging that is really above the normal. And to go from that to the desolation and loneliness of alcoholism, to be hostage to my own self-centeredness in this bondage of self, is brutal for us. It's brutal. So selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. So in this effort to run the show, as it talked about, of the actor who wants to run the whole show, to get everything lined up, to get everything just right, in this effort to do that, I'm driven by this. I'm driven by all the forms of self. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear. I'm driven by self-delusion. I'm driven by self-seeking. And I'm driven by self-pity. Trying to get my own way. Trying to shore up my life. A victim of a delusion that I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if I can just get it right. Man, if I can get them at work, they're not doing it right. If I can get, it'll be good for everybody. It'll be good. Now, I'm not running the show here. I'm trying to make things nice. Nice. If you were doing the same thing, you would be a control freak. But I'm right. See, that's the problem. I'm right. And driven by self-pity. Self-pity is a hideous emotion to be driven by. I couldn't even admit, I was a depressive guy sober when I first got sober. I wouldn't even admit that I was driven by self-pity. I had a guy, I'll tell you, I first copped to it when I was a little sober a little while. And I'm going through this deal. And a guy in AA had this big open house party. And everybody in AA is invited. But he didn't give me a personal invitation. And being sensitive, I'm really attuned to those kind of slights. in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the day of the party comes, and a guy calls me up. He says, aren't you going up to so-and-so's house? Man, it's going to be a lot of fun. No, I'm not going. Well, why not? You know, I really don't feel like I was invited. Well, it's an open house. Everybody's invited. Well, I just don't feel like I'm really wanted there. Well, of course you're wanted there. He likes you. He'd be glad. He wants to have you up there. No, I don't think so. He said, come on up there. You got... No, you go ahead. I'll watch Gilligan's Island and stay at home. That is... Isn't that pathetic? It's just... My friend Scott Redmond, Scott R., says if you could bottle self-pity, it would knock crack off the market in a week. So, just I'm going to finish this point up so I can get off of here. So driven by all this stuff, driven, and you know, we all get that edge to our life. We're driven people in sobriety, driven. Driven by all that stuff, I step on the toes of the people around me, and I don't even know I'm doing it because I can't see anything except how it's got to be a certain way. And when you're like that and you're driven and people try to make suggestions, well, Bob, why don't we do it this way? I won't even know it, but I'll treat you like you're an idiot. I'll give you the cold shoulder. I'll treat you like you're stupid. And what happens is when you're like that and you're wrapped up in self, that all of a sudden these people, you'll end up stepping on their toes, and you don't know you're stepping on their toes. And it's a natural cause and effect. They will retaliate. They will start getting an adversarial position towards you. And it says, the book says, sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. I don't know why. Right? But we will invariably, and this is a vision of what I will find in step four, we will invariably, which means almost always, find that at some time in the past, I have made a decision or have taken a stance or done something based on self that put me in that position to be hurt. And you see, I've never, ever been the victim. I'm the perpetrator of all my separation. I'm the perpetrator of all my conflict. I'm the guy who did it. And yet, for most of my life, I made out cases where it looked like you. Scott? We're going to take a break. That's right.
Five after.
Yeah, five after. That's right.
Howdy, I'm Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic, and very grateful to be here. I'm having a ball. I tell you, Bob really touches me deeply. Didn't you love that lamplighter story and Mary Magdalene? Boy, I just cried. That's me. Oh, man, thank you so much. It's just great stuff. Take me a minute to get organized up here. Couple of things. I think I may have given the impression last night that I thought the steps were the only answer, and I don't believe that, and the book doesn't either. Page 95. This is what worked for me. I'm not saying people who don't work the steps won't stay sober. I'm saying people who do work the steps will all stay sober. Bottom of page 95. We have no monopoly on God. We merely have an approach that worked with us. That's my story. Also, I noticed on page 1 in the text, Bill told my story in a phrase. About 5 or 6 lines down, the great thing alcohol did for me, it says, I was part of life at last. That was it. That was it. That's what happened for me. And page 30, I have the privilege of taking meetings into jails, and... One of the things we like to do, I'd like to make the observation here about 4 lines down, 5 lines down. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. I could sometimes control my drinking, or I could enjoy it, but I could never do them at the same time. If I'm going to control it, I am not going to enjoy it. If I'm going to enjoy it, it is going to be out of control. Thought that was kind of an interesting piece. And what we like to do in the jail... And I hope y'all will play with me, is a show of hands here on page 31. It says, heaven knows we've tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some, not all, some of the methods we've tried. Drinking beer only. Who tried the beer experiment? Right. I'm not drinking any more of that hard stuff. I ain't smoking none of that either. right? Try that one, okay? Never drinking alone. Try that. How about never drinking in the morning? Now I have a point of order. Now, Brandy Alexander is actually just being continental. That's not really drinking, is it? Or Bloody Mary, that's just being social, right? No, that's drinking in the morning. Okay. Drinking only at home. Try that. A sponsored police officer in Metro Nashville says he came up to the scene of a one-car wreck. This car is like wrapped around a bridge abutment or a tree or something. He approaches the driver's side and he says to the guy, because the guy's conscious, he says, "Are you okay?" And the guy says, "You know what, officer? I've absolutely got to stop driving." Made sense to you, didn't it? You bet. Never having it at home. Never having it in the house. Oh, yeah. Never drinking during business hours. Now, hold on, I have a point of order. Lunch is not actually business hours, is it? I don't think that should count, do you? No. Drinking only at parties. Now, I got to tell you right now, I am a party hunting a location. Right? Aren't you? Huh? Switching from scotch to brandy. Did you try from one kind to another of some kind? Boy, I tried that. Drinking only natural wines. Oh, Ripple list. You'd never been anywhere near a grape. Who said that? I'll tell you what I noticed about the natural wines, too. I'd puke really funny colors when I was drinking them. Did you ever notice that really technicolor on that? Agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job. Anybody ever get barricaded at work? Yeah? Okay. Taking a trip, not taking a trip. Don't you love that? We covered both sides of that. Swearing off forever, with and without solemn oath, huh? Who did it? Solemn oath. Yeah, boy. Meant it every time. Taking more physical exercise. Did you try that? I tried to play tennis stoned. I'll tell you something. You can get hurt running and laughing at the same time. That is not safe. Reading inspirational books. Bob said it last night. We're the backbone of the self-help industry. Had everything Ogmandino ever wrote, didn't you? You bet. Going to health farms and sanitariums. Yeah. We call them treatment centers today. Accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. I'm not going to ask for hands on that, and I want you to know I was not a volunteer. When they put me in that insane asylum, I was flat captured. And I was not a volunteer. And put me in the little rubber room, and boy, I think they probably saved my life. That's my story. I was part of life at last. That was why it was so hard for me to lay down, because alcohol worked for me. If it hadn't done so much for me, I don't think it could have ever done anything to me. I think that's Clancy's quote. And boy, that is so true. So true for me. Page 60. Cover some of the things Bob had covered. We're going to be a while on steps 3 and 4 because he and I both believe they're terribly important. Not that anything else isn't, but there's a lot of meat here that I think goes by pretty fast. We covered the ABCs, and I'll emphasize again, God could and would if he were sought, not found. Sought has to do with action. The steps don't call for me to have any results at all. Step 1, Section B says I'm not in management anyway, so I'm not responsible for results. I'm responsible for actions. So the action is to seek. And then it says, being convinced, we were at Step 3. Well, being convinced of what? A, B, and C. And I don't mean to oversimplify, and if you're new, I hope your sponsor's gone to depth with you on the Roman numerals and the first 60 pages. I hope you've really talked about it a lot. But very simply, if A, B, and C are true for you, if you're convinced, I would propose you're at step 3. I think that's what that just said. Which is that we decided to turn our will and life over to God as we understood him. I'd like to observe that on the preceding page on step 3, it uses the word care. Made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. On this page, it says, we decided to turn our will and life over to God as we understood him. I don't have an editorial on that, but I like to observe it. It's kind of important because I see people going one way or another on that. You know, what are you really trying to do here? And I think the important word for me in all of that is the word decided. For me, clearly, step 3 is not where I turn my will and life over to the care of God. It's where I decide to. And my sponsor said there were 3 frogs sitting on a log in the middle of a lake. 2 of them decided to jump into the water. How many left on the log? And I said, 1. He said, no, 3. They just decided to. They haven't jumped yet. And so if it's step 3, I'm going to decide to turn my will and life over to God or over to the care of God, whichever one you want to read, then how do I accomplish the decision? And he said the answers are numbered 4 through 12. And I pointed the first line of step 12 as the evidence of that, having had a spiritual awakening as the result. Spiritually awakened people, to the best of their ability, turn their wills and lives over to the care of God, because it's the best deal there is available. I surrendered for a long, long time. You think about the word surrender in the military connotation. You know, there's blood and noise and screaming and all that. That's my blood. That was me screaming. And then I gave up, and then the battle was over. And I surrendered for a long time, and I don't surrender anymore. I didn't surrender this morning. I got up and volunteered. Same result, but it comes from a very different place. I volunteered in my own enlightened self-interest because this is the best deal I ever had. I didn't fight anymore. Fight's over for me. I'm not surrendering. I'm volunteering. It's a different level. And it's the concept Bob talked about of not closing my mind on something that's now working. If I close my mind on surrender, I can't go to volunteer. If I close my mind on volunteer, I can't go to the next level above that. So to continue to hold in an open mind those things that are given me so that I can build on them. Because I don't ever know when I've got the last one. Maybe I never get the last one in any of these things. Could easily be. And so we decided to turn our will and life over to the care of God as we understood him. The first requirement, aha, there are requirements and there are more than one. A lot of information there. We'd be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Is anybody doubting that? Great. It says, on that basis, we're almost always in collision. How do you like the power in the word? Collision. Blam! Broken glass. Screaming blood. Bent metal. Ambulances on the way. Collision. That would be different from mild disagreement. Almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. This thing for me is not about motive. I hear it in meetings a lot, check your motives, but I can't find where it tells me to do that in the book, with two exceptions. We're not going to go to them. I'm going to tell you very quickly. On pages 69 and 70, it says check your motives when you're going to bed with somebody. Is it selfish? And on pages 100, 101, 102, it says check your motives when you're going someplace where they're serving booze. Are you going there to get vicarious pleasure, or do you really have a good reason to be there? Nowhere else in the book does it tell me to check motives. And I wanted, this was an important lesson for me, and so I'm going to share it. When I got this, I was sober a couple of years. I'm a commissioned salesman by trade. And I had a purchasing agent at a major account that represented about a third of my income. He bought my category. I sold him a lot of stuff. We were personal friends. Our wives were friends. We were guests in each other's homes. We had a lot of spiritual discussions, never a religious one. I mean, this for an earthling, this guy was unbelievable. And his son was born premature, several months. And he called me from the hospital and he said, this child is not doing well. Would you come down and pray over my son? And I said, sure. And I got in my car and I drove to Vanderbilt Hospital. I think I could show you the parking place I was in. And I was sitting there doing what I'd heard in the meetings, checking my motives, and I can't answer the question. I don't know if I'm there to pray over this child to try to bring spiritual help to this family, or if I'm there to pray over this child to get closer to the old man, because he could have bought a lot more stuff from me. He could have doubled that easily. And I'm sitting there just doing what you told me, check my motives, and I can't answer the question. And I prayed about it. And I'm not asking you to believe that the answer I'm going to give you came from there. I'm going to tell you I think it did. I believe that when I need an answer and can't get one of two things has happened here. It's either okay that I make the mistake because I'm going to get the lesson better that way. Or I've asked the wrong question. And the right question on the wrong day, by the way, is still the wrong question. Yeah, the guidance would be right on time. I don't need it 3 weeks in advance. And so I prayed and I said, help me here. And what I got was another question. And the question was, does going into a hospital to pray over a sick child violate any of your principles? And the answer was no. That's good enough. There are no right reasons for doing the wrong thing. There are no wrong reasons for doing the right thing. Yeah, that helped me. And that's the difference between motive and principle. When I operate from motive, I'm trying to govern the results. I'll give you an example. I'm about to make up a story out of my past that never happened to help you get a lesson. It's a great motive. What's wrong? It's a lie. Sure, it violates principle. And when I do that, what I'm trying to do is govern the outcome. Step 1, section B, I'm not management. I'm not responsible for the outcome. I'm responsible for the actions. And what principle does is it governs my action irrespective of outcome. It's a very important thing to me. And I don't find any place else in the book that tells me, and I'm not going to quote all the pages. There's a bunch of them. But my favorite there is still at the top of page 60. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to have good motives on all our affairs. That's not what it says. That is not what it says. Practice these principles. That was a big lesson for me. So that's I wanted to highlight it because it meant so much to me. And it says, each person, like the actor, wants to run the whole show. Whoever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if people would only... Did you notice that it's not the director we're talking about? This is one of the actors. It's the director's job. This is one of the actors. Didn't say it was the star of the show. It's not the star. Not the co-star. This guy may not even have a speaking part. There are a lot of times when he shouldn't have a speaking part. I know that. My wife, Miss Linda, says one of the great Al-Anon prayers is, God, please keep your arm around my shoulders and your hand over my mouth. I got to step out of the business of trying to run this thing, and I think that's really important. Let's go ahead and turn the page. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven. How do you like that word, driven? Not mildly disabled on rare occasion, right? Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. Let's take a look at that series of words. Now, they're going to appear in different, slightly different form all over the book. Let's hang on to 62. We're coming back to it. Take a look at 67. Second paragraph, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had we been? Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Pretty much the same list. Pretty much. 84. Two-thirds of the way down the page. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Page 86. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Page 88. Third line. Excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. Not the same list, but pretty close. 145. Paragraph begins in the middle of the page. The greatest enemies of us alcoholics are resentment, jealousy, envy, frustration, and fear. This is analysis by me, all right, I warn you now, red flags. Those things look to me like the earmarks of self. They really are the earmarks of self. I heard this, a fellow from Houston tells us, resentment is when I didn't get my will in the past. Anger and depression when I'm not getting my will right now. And fear is the concern that I won't get my will in the future. Keeps coming back to my will. And this list, here we are in 62, 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. Bob covered that so beautifully. It's all the self thing, self in the fore. Reemergence of self, the ugliest thing in the world. My sponsor told me before this next paragraph, he said, you're fixing to get the best news you'll ever get in your whole life. I said, really? Okay. Hit me with it. He said, so our troubles we think are basically of our own making. Is that it? That's it? I know it doesn't sound that good to me. He said, that's the best news you'll ever get. Because if it really is the cops, the courts, the blacks, the Chinese, the Russians, the PTA, the ex-wife, if it really is them, you're cooked. Because we can't do a thing about them. The good news is you are the problem. And with a little willingness on your side, we can work on that. Oh, didn't sound that good. It says they arise out of ourselves. The alcoholic's an extreme example of self-will run riot. He doesn't usually think so. Above everything. Now, I wonder how important that is. Above everything. That's somewhere right around the middle, isn't it? Above everything. We alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. Gee, I wonder why. Well, it'll kill us, it says here only. We're threatening your life. We're going to do that a lot in the next few pages. It says often... I think when there's a concept presented in the book more than once, it's important. I think when there's a concept presented in the book more than once on the same page, it's real important. More than once in the same paragraph, I think they're trying to tell me something. No way of entirely getting rid of self without His aid, capital H, His aid. That was it. Many of us had moral, philosophical convictions galore. Could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. Concept's in there twice. Self isn't going to push self out of the center. It can't. All right, it says, this is the how and the why, but first of all, we had to quit playing God. Now, time out. I thought we had a first two pages before that. The first requirement, be convinced any life run on self will hardly be a success. So we have two things in first place there. If I could have got two things down to two things in first place, I might still be out there running hard. Right? I had thousands of things in first place, didn't you? Okay, so this one is, we had to quit playing God. And I sat at the feet of one, I call him one of the masters, the grand masters of this thing we do. And I sat with him. I had him a whole morning all by myself, and I asked a lot of questions. And then he stopped once, and he asked me a question. He said, here on page 62, you agreed to quit playing God. I said, yes. He said, how'd you play God? I said, I don't know. And he said, here's how I played God. Someone would die, and I'd be angry. And that's me saying, I know who should die and how and when. I played God because I tried to manage my own life and those around me. And the closer you were to me, the harder I tried to manage your life. And clearly God's job, not mine. I judged people. And the reason I know that is because I had resentment. And the only way to get a resentment is to judge someone, find them guilty, be angry with them, and then feel that anger again. The word resent comes from the Latin. Re, R-E, means again. Like reread, it's something you read another time. Sentire means to feel. And in English, what we feel again is old anger. That's what resent literally means. It's old anger. And I had resentments, I therefore had judged. Those are the ones he had. I've added some since then. I needed to know. I asked the question, why? And that's my spiritual arrogance saying, if I can collect enough data, I can, like Bob said, take God's job and run this whole thing. Another one was that I was sure that everything I knew for sure was correct. Boy, does that block me. And isn't that playing God? And another one was that I trusted my motives. And I've come up with some good motives to do some of the ugliest things you can imagine. I'm going to spare you and not list them, but trust me, it's not a pretty story. Okay, so we had to quit playing God. And here's a wonderful reason. It didn't work. Oh. Remember that first rule of cavalry? When the horse is dead, dismount. Not me, baby. I'm going to the whip. I just, maybe we get this thing's attention. Next, we decided. So here's the decision we talk about. I break step three down into about nine parts. So you just saw the first two. All right, here's the decision we call for. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He's the principal. We're His agents. He's the Father. We're His children. And the perspective I'm going to take for the rest of the time we're together is how I coach a new man through these 12 steps. Please don't feel like I'm telling you what to do. I am not. Please disagree. I'd love it. I may learn something. Please, your sponsor's right. I'm wrong if there's a disagreement. This is simply what I do. And at this point, I ask him for a decision. Have you made that decision? Have we heaped enough evidence on you? Have you heaped it on yourself as to what happens when you manage? Have you had enough? Are you done? And if the answer is yes, and if you want some time to think about this, please take it. This is not a lightweight decision. And when you're ready, I want you to read that to me in the first person. And he will read, I have decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God is going to be my director. He is the principal. I am his agent. He is the Father. I am His child. And I will say, I think you've made an excellent